Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us for an early morning session. I want to introduce Audrey Waters to you. You heard her at the Horizon Report panel that we had a couple days ago, but she's here to talk a little bit more about makerspaces. So let me tell you a little bit about Audrey. Audrey's a writer and a folklorist and self-described tech gypsy. And she covers education technology news. You maybe follow her blog. She's worked in the education field in some form or another for the past 15 years as a graduate student, a college instructor, a program manager for an ed tech nonprofit. And Audrey writes about educational technology issues, she says, with one foot firmly in the world of internet technologies and one foot firmly in the world of education. So, Audrey, welcome and thank you.
Morning, everybody. So, this is not a talk about MOOCs. This is not a talk about online learning. This is not a talk about learning analytics or learning management systems or any of the hot new ed tech apps that have investors and entrepreneurs and administrators and professors sort of up in arms with both excitement and panic and reticence, and have students, I think, pretty indifferent. This isn't a talk about David Brooks and his campus tsunami, nor is it a talk about Thomas Friedman and his MOOC revolution, nor is it a talk a response to the technology tabloid TechCrunch and its pronouncement, its gleeful pronouncement, that this all marks the end of the university as we know it. Except this is a talk about all of those things, just as it really desperately wants to point to somewhere else. This isn't to deny the existence of MOOCs or the like or to refute their significance. This is a talk that, even when it focuses elsewhere, recognizes this hype and the opportunity and the challenges for teachers, for students, for administrators, and for educational institutions. But this talk wants to make the case for schools to look to the maker culture, not to markets, in order to keep themselves relevant, to reinvigorate them, to help have students become engaged, to help make their learning meaningful and empowered. Much of the punditry I hear today about EdTech hails this as the moment when teaching and learning will move online. We all know here, of course, that this trend isn't actually new at all. The internet is decades old, computers are decades old, EdTech is decades old. EdTech online and off, so the argument goes, right, will make education more efficient, more scalable, more personalized. It will liberate students from these wretched lecture halls by videotaping the lectures and by putting them on the internet. Now, whether or not you believe that this will be more efficient or more scalable or more personalized, and I honestly think we need to debate all of those things, this is the promise that some say that we're at right now, that we're being offered. And thanks to the move online, thanks to digital opportunities, we're now going to be able to do something different in our face-to-face learning environments. So what does that difference look like? Now, I know when I compare these two photos, one photo of Sebastian Thrun, an artificial intelligence professor at Stanford, the co-founder of Udacity, standing in front of an empty lecture hall, and I compare it to 9-year-old Kane Monroy standing in front of his cardboard arcade, I really do know where I'd like to be learning. It's with Kane, in case that he didn't figure that out. Now, clearly, despite the internet, despite computers, we can make a case for offline and face-to-face learning opportunities, for better offline learning opportunities. And I think we can make a case still today for physical learning spaces, for better and for beautiful physical learning spaces. This is a very long-winded introduction, I realize, to making a case for a makerspace on your campus. But it's a case that I think hopefully invokes some of the educational practices that we know are the best that work very well. Small group discussions, collaboration, participatory, peer-to-peer and project-based learning, experimentation, inquiry, curiosity, fun, play. These practices, these are values that I think we should encourage as we help students build and learn to make their own knowledge. The makerspace is something that's grown out of what's called the maker movement, a loose affiliation of software and hardware hackers and hobbyists of all sorts. And I should note here, when I say hackers, I don't mean criminals who are trying to sort of steal your social security number and break into your Gmail account. I mean tinkerers, really, people who are willing to play and experiment with technology. The maker movement is a contemporary version, if you will, of that old punk rock ethos and DIY culture, just with newer technology. Perhaps, if you remember, if you're old enough to remember, the old zine that had the photo of the three chords that say, learn these three chords and now go form a band. And in some way, the maker movement is a similar sort of thing. Here, take these two sensors and a motherboard and go build a computer. Makerspaces are sort of a newer version as well of that old Silicon Valley homebrew computer club, whose members most famously included Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. But the makerspace is also more public-facing. It's more community-oriented. From what we've seen from the sort of individual DIY hobbyists or small hobby groups, from those folks who work in their basements, who work in their garage, who have workshops and sewing rooms and living rooms. The maker movement brings them out into the open, into the public, so that they can share and teach and learn together. The maker movement is closely associated with Make Magazine, which is sometimes described as the 21st century popular mechanics, and maker fairs that the publication has helped organize all around the world. There are many resources, though, many traditions that makers draw from, many places where they gather. I recently recognized the maker movement as one of the most important edtech trends of last year. And although it is making some inroads into schools, I think it is really notable here that much of what we see in the maker movement, in that joy of learning, is something that happens in informal rather than formal environments. So for those of us that work in formal education settings, I think we need to ask ourselves, why does that joy, why does that interest lie outside our walls? What does the maker movement get right, and what can we learn from it? Makers work with Arduino, paper mache, Legos, cardboard, robots, rockets, welding machines, gears, circuit boards, computer-assisted drawing software, string, vinyl cutters, LED lights, the command line, rubber bands, wire, duct tape, Play-Doh, Steamworks, sensors, hot glue guns, scissors, Raspberry Pis. That's a $35 little cardboard-sized computer, not the dessert. Gyroscopes, Tesla coils, musical instruments, fire, water cannons, plastic, wood, motors, solar power, wearable computers, and 3D printers, for starters. It's the latter, quite arguably, that's the technology that actually appeared on this year's Horizon Report for Higher Ed. It's really spurred a lot of the imagination and the excitement about the possibilities of bringing the sort of low-cost and local manufacturing. 3D printers will bring about the next industrial revolution, says The Economist magazine. They will revive American manufacturing, says Forbes. Now, depending on your geography and maybe the composition of your engineering departments and your business departments, your school may or may not give a damn about the future of American manufacturing. There might be faculty on your campus who roll their eyes with all this talk of STEM majors and STEM skills and STEM jobs. There might be those who are perhaps rightly concerned that all this talk about STEM will mean sort of that they're on the sort of the they'll get the axe when it comes time for budgetary decisions, so if they are sort of non-STEM, i.e. not relevant, not 21st century academic departments. But I'd argue, actually, that we all need to give a damn about the future of American, the future of manufacturing, because I think manufacturing, particularly with the 3D printer, is changing. As Make Magazine founder Dale Daugherty says, we must see manufacturing as a creative enterprise, not something where you're told what to do, but where you're invited to solve a problem and figure things out together. And I think despite our varied disciplinary backgrounds, we should really all give a damn about the future of science and technology and engineering and math, and I'd add in art as well. Indeed, the maker movement and maker spaces, they aren't something for just those in the engineering department. They aren't just something for computer scientists or those who do design. They aspire to be openly democratic and participatory. And I think that's one of their great, great beauties. Now, Steve Jobs once famously said that Apple's innovation was a result of the company existing at the intersection of technology and the liberal arts. And with that in mind, I think we can do a lot more to situate our colleges and universities at that intersection, too. Certainly not by scrapping humanities departments, and honestly not by buying iPads, really. Really, it's by welcoming the maker community, by welcoming that maker ethos into our campus. For many years now, we've talked about what it means to have writing across the curriculum. We've decided as institutions that we think students, all students, no matter what they major in, need to write often, they need to write well, they need to write critically. And so I think it's come time to ask, what would it look like to have making across the curriculum? The opportunities for hands-on learning actually are really quite few in our modern-day educational institutions. They're few, and sadly, they're getting fewer. Our education system has forgotten, or I don't know, I mean, perhaps ignored is a better word, John Dewey and his argument that we learn by doing. At the K-12 level, wood shop, metal shop, sewing, cooking, art, heck, even the science lab, they're going away. They're going away to save money, and they're going away to make more time in the school year for college prep and for standardized testing. But we learn by doing. We learn by making. I don't think we necessarily learn by clicking. Makerspaces give students, they give all students, an opportunity for this hands-on experimentation, for prototyping, for problem solving, for design thinking. By letting students make, whether they're making digital artifacts or physical artifacts, we can support them in gaining these critical skills. By making a pinball machine in physics class, for example, by making paper or doing bookbinding in literature classes, by building an app in a poli-sci class, 3D modeling, perhaps, in your archaeology class, 3D printing for nursing. They're 3D printing body parts nowadays, or experimental body parts. So the opportunities are, I think, really endless. Blacksmithing for history class. I mean, why the hell not? I mean, besides, you know, the fire and molten metal. I mean, but really, the possibilities are endless. And really, I mean, with the exception perhaps of putting a forge on your campus, the cost of making a makerspace nowadays really isn't, it isn't that high. And let me reiterate here, the project-based component of making is really important. Making rather than writing final projects for a class, it will still demand that students do research. It'll still demand that students plan. But it also demands that they prototype in ways that neither an exam or an essay really do. Making projects can be, oh my God, horrors. They can be relevant, right? They can be meaningful. They can be experimental. They can be technological, and they can use technology to build them. They can be technological whether you're majoring in the classics or whether you're majoring in computer science. And frankly, I think these days, they should be. Makerspaces expose students to cutting-edge technologies that could in turn lead to employment and entrepreneurial activities. And because makerspaces are connected to open source hardware and open source software, students aren't just learning how to use proprietary systems. They aren't just learning how to use a specific piece of software or a specific brand of tool. Instead, they're learning how to find resources. They're learning how to work together. And this is key, I think. They're learning how to learn. Having some technological know-how, of course, tech literacy, sure, we can call it that, but also just a comfort level with technical experimentation and with tinkering is becoming increasingly fundamental for all of us, as technology, no doubt, is shaping how we learn, how we communicate, how we play, and how we work. There's a growing number of makerspaces that support these sorts of learning and building experiments. Some charge a membership fee, some charge a materials fee, some are for-profit, some are not-for-profit. Regardless of their tax status, they tend to be very community-oriented. No surprise, really, makerspaces then are popping up in community centers. They're being built in libraries. They're being built in K-12 schools. And they're popping up on college campuses. There's the Think Lab at the University of Mary Washington, the Maker Lab at the University of Victoria, and I should add that most of the photos in this slide deck come from one or other of those schools. There's the Garage at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the Science Library at University of Nevada in Reno, the Library at Valdosta State College, the Open Hardware Makerspace at North Carolina State University, the Fab Lab at Stanford. One recent estimate put the number of makerspaces on college campuses at around 60. So for those keeping score at home, that's about double than the number of campuses who've signed on for Coursera. So tell me. Now, by and large, these makerspaces are not associated with any one department. Indeed, I think that's part of the argument that librarians are making about opening the makerspaces there. The library is already open to the entire academic community, to students, to faculty of all disciplines. The library is the place where you meet in the stacks people who are looking for books near you who you might never take classes with. And that openness, right, the openness to the public, the openness to different disciplines, the openness to different skill levels, makes the makerspace, I think, very, very different than the science lab, for example, or the art studio. These are the two places that are perhaps the closest, in terms of equipment at least, to what you'd find in the makerspace. You needn't take a series of prerequisite classes in order to gain access to the tools in a makerspace, although makerspaces do tend to offer classes for those who are interested in learning more. Classes in makerspaces tend to be casual. They aren't often for credit. And I think that this offers a lot of possibilities, too, particularly when it comes to things like learning to solder or learning to code. These are skills that students might not have the confidence or the opportunity to learn otherwise. And I think, and this is a huge interest of mine, this is particularly the case in subject areas that have traditionally excluded women. So a makerspace is a safe place to learn. Unlike the sort of scripted experiments that often happen in the undergraduate science lab, look at this slide, identify this rock, add this chemical, measure this arc, experimentation in a makerspace is inquiry-based. It's much more open and free-form. It's learner-focused. It's learner-driven. It's cross-disciplinary. And such, it's really undisciplined, I think, in the best possible way. And I think the flourishing maker movement really demonstrates that people are hungry for this. They're hungry for these opportunities that they might not otherwise have. We want to play. We want to build. We want to make. We want to hack. These are very human impulses, I think. And the informal learning opportunities are becoming more and more widely available to pursue this sort of thing, right? As the old adage goes, you can learn anything you want on the internet. But in many ways, I think it's important, again, to recognize that these informal activities are much more attractive, oftentimes, than the formal ones. College classes cost money. They come with a slew of requirements and mandatory assignments and final exams and the like. you must study this, then you must study that, and you must take this class in order to get your degree, and so on. And I think that making can happen with any level of skill, with any sort of materials. Kane's Arcade, for example, it's an elaborate cardboard arcade built by a 9-year-old in his dad's auto parts store. It's a brilliant example of what you can do with some cardboard and a rich imagination. But making can happen, this isn't something that just happens for 9-year-olds, right? Cardboard isn't something that just nine-year-olds love to play with. From a blog post from Tim Owen's freshman seminar, MakerBots and Mashups at the University of Mary Washington, there's the following from a freshman. Signing up for my freshman seminar class, I had no idea what mashups and marker bots would entail. All I knew is that I needed another class on Tuesdays and Thursdays sometime after 3 p.m. Imagine my surprise when I found out that the class title had a typo in it, and it really meant something cooler, 3D printing. Now imagine my even greater surprise to find out on the second day of class we were supposed to make something out of cardboard. Yet there were very few instructions on this first assignment, just make something out of cardboard, and it has to move. Most people started working on their cardboard automata by looking at well-made ones online and drawing out exactly what the box would do, how the box would do it, what the box would look like. I, on the other hand, decided to start making my box without a single idea in my mind. The first part I made were gears. I figured I could probably figure out how to use them while cutting them out. After they were made, I attached them to wooden rods and put them together to see how it would all work. After about 10 minutes of playing with them to see how I could incorporate them into my box, I decided to trash the idea altogether and go look for a better idea. Now, I'd say that that's actually a pretty important lesson about planning and prototyping to learn on day 2 of your freshman year in college, actually. And it's a lesson learned via cardboard. It's a lesson learned via making. So let me repeat something that I said at the beginning of the talk. EdTech, online and offline, so one argument goes, will make education more efficient, more scalable, more personalized. It will liberate students from those terrible, wretched, large lecture halls by videotaping the lectures and putting them on the internet. The EdTech that fuels makerspaces does something very, very different. It recognizes, I think, that learning is messy. It recognizes the small and local still matters. Unlike adaptive learning tools, for example, this isn't personalized learning as some sort of marketing message. This is personal learning. This is deeply personal learning. And, of course, I mean, by all means, the makerspace can provide an alternative to large lecture halls. Not just via the internet, though, but on the campus itself. So what does it mean to create an informal learning space on a college campus? Are maker culture and academic culture even compatible? That's an interesting question, I think, actually, to which I respond, because that's how I respond to these sort of questions, that maybe we need to think a bit more whether academic culture and market culture are compatible before we get too concerned about the makers. And regardless, I think we do need to ask what sort of institutional support students might need, if any, to participate in makerspaces. How can we make sure everyone feels welcome there? Will some students only want to make if it's part of a college assignment? Will they only want to make if they get credit? Does making as a course requirement impact their willingness to experiment? Does it change? Does making change when it happens on a college campus in this sort of environment? Perhaps. But perhaps, too, by bringing makerspaces to college campuses, the influence can flow the other way. Perhaps the maker movement can help shift the academic landscape away from a teacher-focused endeavor towards a more learner-focused one, Perhaps it can prompt us to rethink our assignments. Perhaps it can force us to evolve our expectations of what college students can do, what college students should do. With makerspaces on campus, perhaps we'll see more experimentation. Perhaps we'll see more risk-taking, more iteration, more rapid prototyping, more innovation. Perhaps we'll see more cross-disciplinary interactions. The 3D printer, perhaps that will become the new water cooler. More sharing, perhaps we'll see more relevancy. And I think it would be great to see our students build more technical projects. And most importantly, and this is, I think, the piece that I hope everyone takes away, the technologies that we find in the makerspace are technologies in the hands of students. Makerspaces mean that students are not the objects of technology. They are the subjects. They have agency in a makerspace. They have control over what they want to build. They are not just the consumers of technology. They are the creators. They are makers and builders and thinkers. And really, at the end of the day, isn't that what we want all learners to be? Thank you. So I'm not sure if anyone here has a makerspace on their campus or interested in makerspaces on their campus, but I'm happy to entertain any sorts of questions about what that would look like, the good, the bad, the ugly, the problematic, particularly if we want to talk about forging.
And thanks again for using the microphone so our online audience can hear.
Hi, I love it. And I want a makerspace. I want a makerspace in my house. I love one in my library. But there's one thing that you mentioned in the middle of your talk. You talked about writing across the curriculum. Mm-hmm. And what I wonder is if there needs to be a making across the curriculum corollary that would help support these labs. My fear is that I would go back, and I'm based in a library, I'd go back to my library, I'd say, we're making this thing, we'd spend hundreds of thousands of dollars putting this thing up, and it would sit there empty. And so what I really want to have is some kind of curricular tie-in so that I would know that students are coming through. And I know you thought about this, and so if you could tell me some about it, I'd love to hear it.
Well, the first thing is I think that it certainly doesn't have to be hundreds of thousands of dollars investment. I've seen makerspaces at the K-12 level where really what they have are a bunch of glue sticks and construction paper. I mean, I would imagine that most college students are not going to really find glue sticks and construction paper that appealing. But even at the 3D printers today, the cost of 3D printers has come down substantially. So for the MakerBots, for example, can run you $1,000, $2,000. So this doesn't have to actually be sort of a huge investment. It's certainly not the sort of investment to sort of fill a science lab with high-powered microscopes. But I think the question of what making across the curriculum would look like is a really important one. And I think that this is the place for faculty to really think about how can they ask their students to have a variety of projects that they build that aren't associated with just sort of the essay or the final exam. And what does it mean to sort of have a physical artifact or a digital artifact, but a physical artifact is a component of what you're looking at? What does it mean when you could sort of examine things on a three dimension? What does it mean to sort of print and prototype the world that way? And I've heard of people doing some really incredibly interesting things. I mentioned a pinball machine in a physics class, but I've seen composition writers who are teaching freshman comp, for example, have the MakerBot, or use 3D printing and MakerBots in their classes. So they're asking students to think about design and conceptualizing ideas in a three-dimensional way, which I think challenges students in sort of ways that they aren't necessarily being asked to do already. So I think the possibilities are pretty open, but I do think it will require people incorporating it into their course requirements. But I do think opening things up, particularly in library lets there be a certain amount of experimentation where folks who are just sort of maker curious can come and experiment with the tools that they wouldn't otherwise have access to. So I sort of danced around here.
Thank you so much for your talk. Following up on that question just a little bit, connections between maker culture and the studio arts.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking very specifically of pottery or, you know, places where the act of making could be interpretively related across the curriculum. I'm also interested in maker culture as it might be related to business and entrepreneurial function. So again, that whole process of innovation, which you allude to, becomes part of building, developing an idea into a business.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in many ways the art design studios have had some of these pretty cool tools for a long time. The CNC cutters, laser cutters, working with these sorts of equipment. But I think the difference between a maker space, as I said earlier, is that it's something that's open to everyone. You don't have to sort of sign up and take an art class in order to get to play around with this equipment. I do think that a lot of the things that are taught in a design class, particularly when it comes to sort of modeling things on a computer and then making sort of a physical manifestation of that, those are skills that people will pick up outside that discipline. I think the connection to entrepreneurship is really important and really interesting as well, and I think that that's why people are so excited about the 3D printers. Right now, the MakerBots, for example, they build things with plastic. The things that they print are with plastic and dust. But the opportunities are multiple for other things that we can print. As I said earlier, people are experimenting with printing organs, printing new body parts. Turning these sort of new tools over to students and ask them to think about experimentation, but then also ask them how can this be relevant for sort of furthering opportunities. And I think when people talk about reviving American manufacturing, this isn't just about learning to work on a factory line. This is about sort of learning to build your own business in your garage. I mean, that the technology is affordable to the level that it hasn't been previously. So I do think there are a lot of entrepreneurial activities. And I think this notion of rapid prototyping, iteration, learning to fail, back to the drawing board, problem solving, are incredibly important skills for all of us, but they're very important entrepreneurial skills as well.
Hi, this has been great, thank you. I'm kind of curious about the spectrum of where you see these spaces growing out of. So you talked about the library and kind of the more formal side of, you know, institutionally provided. And I'm curious about, in a highly residential campus, are you seeing these be student-driven and come out of sort of the residential experience? Like, I want this in my dorm kind of driven stuff.
The open hardware place at North Carolina State is a student-oriented project, and this is something that they're recognizing. I mean, it's sort of in the student center as opposed to in the library, which I think is sort of a false divide, but sort of an institutional center versus the student center. And the interesting thing about that particular place is that they're also very committed to going out and connecting as students to the community and working with K-12 schools. And so again, I think it is cracking open the walls of campus so that there's a recognition that what happens there is part of a larger community. So it's the residential on-campus experience, and it's that community. It's that university community. But I think that many students are recognizing that this is something that needs to be more broadly accessible, particularly for young students who might be interested in robotics and 3D printing as well.
You talked a little bit in your talk about the connections between universities and colleges and maker culture, and one of the things that occurs to me is the openness mm-hmm. aspect, that it's sort of the opposite of proprietary information. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about openness and maker culture.
I think that, you know, the maker culture, I mean, one of the things I think if you look, even if you look at the development of 3D printers, for example. So 3D printers have been around for quite some time, and they used to cost tens of thousands of dollars. But thanks, in fact, to sort of these hobbyist groups and open source hobbyist groups, that's where a lot of these sort of new versions, the MakerBot, for example, grew out of sort of open hardware hackers. And so this is something that people have worked to sort of bring down the costs themselves. So I think this notion of openness is incredibly important in order to sort of generate innovation, to be able to turn things over to, you know, to the community to debug, to build and debug. The skill of debugging, I mean, we talk about debugging in software, but we don't think about it necessarily in its offline or hardware components, but debugging is an incredibly important sort of critical skill. Can you figure out what went wrong, where, and why, and go back to that moment and then sort of iterate from there? And so I think that openness to sort of share your ideas with other people, to ask for feedback from other people, to hand ideas over to a community rather than to keep them to yourself is really part of the maker ethos. And I think that's why this notion of sort of teaching and sharing that you see around maker fairs and in maker spaces is incredibly powerful. And I think a lot of the tools that we're seeing, a lot of the hardware tools that maker spaces work with do tend to be open source hardware.
How are these spaces on campuses usually governed? So I'm part of a hackerspace in Arizona, and it's really messy, you know.
It is messy.
I'd like to know what the typical model for this governance for the governance of these makerspaces on campuses are, and also some of the maintenance problems with, you know, the 3D printers. I mean, our 3D printers, we've gone through maybe four of them, and it's a running joke. If you're not a real hackerspace, then you've got three rep wraps in the corner that are broken, you know. So, I mean, sometimes it requires a total rebuild. So, I mean, sometimes you don't have that expertise. Like I was talking to some people over there on the table. I mean, they're a liberal arts college. They don't have the engineering people in there to really kind of look at this and be able to fix those things. So,
what's actually quite interesting to me is that when I look at a lot of the programs that are working on building makerspaces, many of them are at liberal arts colleges. They aren't necessarily something that engineering departments and computer science departments are being responsible for. And I don't know if that goes back to the sort of a culture of openness. I'm not trying to argue that like engineers are closed and liberal arts people are open. But I do wonder if there's something about having to sort of turn things over to the community for more assistance that I think perhaps those with in a liberal arts institution are more accustomed to doing, rather than having this legacy of closed systems and of sort of requirements to have students participate. Your question about messiness and your question about governance, I think, is really interesting. And I think it really varies depending on where the makerspace exists on campus. Is this something that is the library's handling, or is this sort of a more student-run? Is there a particular department or section that monitors it? So I think that the governance procedures are quite different. And some do have some rules about, some have more rules than others in terms of like what you can do without having someone sort of show you how the 3D printer works, for example. And in terms of the breakage, I think that this is another really important thing as well. I think it's the University of Nevada in Reno. They have 3D printers in their libraries that have been running nonstop, actually, since they purchased them. And they've sort of realized how much money and how much uptake or upkeep this actually entails. And so this isn't something that just sort of you build it and then it's sort of self-sustaining, but I think that in some ways, if you're building a community around it, it does become sustaining in a different sort of way. And you're building the capacity of people on your campus, you're building the capacity of students to be able to problem solve and maintain and manage and negotiate these things. And again, those are very, very important skills rather than, I think, handing things over to other forces to manage them. I think, you know, there's something about makerspaces that have the sort of shared governance and shared responsibility for the equipment and for what's created there that I think is, again, it's, I think it's an interesting model for but a messy model for higher education to consider.
Hi, Audrey. Steve Greenlaw from the University of Mary Washington. Mary Washington is a liberal arts college, a small liberal arts college, and we do have a makerspace, and I'm not affiliated with it. I've been to it, and I've thought a lot about it. And this conference has actually helped me get my thinking together, I think. you guys will be the judge of this. One of the things that we talk about is the importance of deep learning, and deep learning requires transfer. And I think that is part of the draw of makerspaces. Makerspaces promote creativity and problem solving in domains different than most of our students are familiar with. Mm-hmm. And so it seems to me that makerspaces are a metaphor for teaching our students how to approach and solve ill-structured problems, which are the types of problems increasingly that our students are going to confront in their careers and lives. And that, I think, is the draw, especially at a liberal arts school.
I agree. And I think it's a metaphor, but it's actually substantive and real. And so, and I think that's why I think the values of tinkering and the values of hacking are really important. And it's because problem solving doesn't always have a fixed and finite answer. Because if you solve something one day, that doesn't mean that you've solved it forever. I think that there's a way that you can sort of have the quick and dirty workaround that make things work for now, that make things work for the short term, and recognize that you're always going to have to be iterating, that you're always going to have to be learning, that the skills that you take away from any opportunity, but from particularly the skills and the knowledge that you take away from a four-year undergraduate degree are not sort of the end-all be-all, that the classes that you take, that the major that you follow is somehow the sort of finite box of knowledge that you then get to sort of carry forward unchanging into your work worlds. So I think knowing that you have to sort of tinker and futz around with things and hack and make and go back to the drawing board again and again and again, and go back to the drawing board not just sort of in your mind, but to prototype with technology is, I think, the inescapable future for all of us. And it's not necessarily about learning to be more efficient, I think, but it's actually learning to realize the sort of messiness of this whole endeavor. Great. Well, thank you. Thank you, everybody.